Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, what's going on in Burma? You know about violent crackdowns by the country's military dictatorship, which are covered in the U.S. press, but you'd be hard-pressed to know that the nonviolent pro-democracy movement there has been organizing for years. We'll talk to Cynthia Boaz, a professor at SUNY Brockport and academic advisor to the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, about Burma and the press. Also on the show, none other than the maestro, former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan, has stated that Social Security does not face a looming crisis. Normally, his word is gospel with the press corps. So why was the Social Security crisis not a question but a presumption at the recent Democratic candidates debate, as in much corporate media conversation? We'll discuss the reasons for the canard that won't die with Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
When leading Democratic candidates John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama agreed in the Democratic debate on September 26 that the next president could not pledge to end the war in less than 5 years, media pundits cheered. NBC's network correspondent David Gregory praised the Democrats for being pragmatic and centrist. For Gregory, this showed that the Democrats were saying to the left wing of their party, quote, "We've got to be pragmatic about this. We can't lose the general election because of your feelings about the war." Close quote. NPR reporter Juan Williams echoed this sentiment, saying the front runners, quote, "understand America's interest in Iraq to the point that they are willing to say to their base, a base that wants to get out, no, you know what? We may have to be there to protect American interests till 2013. Close quote. Williams commended the Democrats for being honest and responsible and said, quote, "that's the kind of leadership we want," close quote. And a Boston Herald editorial hailed the new realism of the top-tier Democrats, declaring, quote, "it seems the delicate Democratic dance towards the great American middle, where elections are won, has already begun," close quote. But keeping troops in Iraq until after 2013 hardly represents a pragmatic or centrist position, given that recent polls show 64% of Americans oppose the war and just 5% want to see U.S. troops in Iraq that long. When pundit approval seems more important than public opinion, it gives concrete meaning to the term punditocracy.
You can't always judge a newspaper article from its headline, but sometimes you can. Take the September 28th Washington Post story headlined, "With Legacy in Mind, Bush Reassesses His Agenda." The lead example of the White House changing course was the fact that Bush was convening a climate change conference. A big surprise, we're told, since he has, quote, "invested little personal energy in the challenge of global warming." Now, with the end in sight, he has called the biggest nations of the world together to press for a plan by the end of next year, close quote. So the Post sees a shift in position for Bush, who rejected the Kyoto Treaty and has expressed doubt that humans have anything to do with climate change, because the White House's stated goal is to have a real plan by next year. That's thin enough, but the conference Bush convened actually represented very little change. The White House was still avoiding mandatory emissions caps, and the meeting was timed to pull attention away from the UN climate change talks. But articles like this are an elite media standard. A White House suggests they're really about to change course on an important issue, and gullible reporters fall for it. After the hoopla, readers sometimes can get a better sense of what actually happened. Washington Post internet readers, for example, could read Dan Frumkin's analysis, "Bush's Climate Charade." But it's worth remembering that this isn't even the first time the White House has done this year. In May, the administration announced it was planning these climate change talks, and that produced similarly credulous articles about the White House reassessing and taking the lead and so forth. It's no wonder they keep pitching this storyline. There's always someone in the media ready to buy it.
Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is notoriously averse to media, so it was a rare occasion, the publication of his new memoir, My Grandfather's Son, when he agreed to an interview with 60 Minutes correspondent Steve Croft. Seeing the results, aired on September 30th, one wonders why he ever hesitated. Croft gave Thomas free rein to recall his poor childhood and the grandfather who instilled in him the values of hard work and perseverance, which seems fair enough, though Croft could have asked why, if he is so much his grandfather's son, Thomas rejects the civil rights that his grandfather, an outspoken member of the NAACP, championed. Much of the rest of the interview fell short of anything resembling journalism. Instead, Croft allowed Thomas to settle old political scores pretty much uninterrupted by any probing questions or countervailing opinions. For instance, when Thomas suggested Anita Hill, a former colleague who testified before Thomas's 1991 Senate confirmation hearing that he'd acted in a sexually inappropriate manner towards her, had falsely testified, Croft let the remark stand, failing to point out that other witnesses corroborated Hill's testimony and other women had come forward making similar claims. The interview has come in for some criticism. On Tavis Smiley's October 1st PBS show, one panelist, former New Orleans mayor and Urban League executive Mark Morial, called Croft's interview an advertorial for Thomas and chided Croft for failing to ask Thomas, who insisted that he was concerned about African Americans and disadvantaged people, to explain how he'd used, quote, the power of his office, either at the EEOC, on the D.C. Circuit, or on the Supreme Court, to help those he professed to be concerned about, close quote. That's pretty much how we saw it, too. Croft, who had one of the most powerful and controversial people in the country in the hot seat on a show renowned for its tough questions, seemed to forget what he was doing there.
A New York Times article on September 27th advanced a peculiar theory about health care coverage. Apparently, it's bad because it takes away the main incentive people have not to get sick. In a piece on the new GM labor deal, Detroit bureau chief Micheline Maynard took aim at the cushy health care coverage the automaker gave its workers. Quote, UAW members, assured of health care benefits that were the envy of the labor movement, had little incentive to take better care of their health, since their generous coverage would pay for most any ailment, close quote. The assumption here is that high health care costs are mainly a matter of people not taking care of themselves because they won't have to pay for their illnesses, as if people are eating that third Big Mac and saying, who cares? Insurance will pay for my heart attack. Most folks don't think it works that way, and someone should also clue the reporter in that even people who eat right and exercise do eventually get sick and die 100% of the time. What's more, if, say, the prospect of lung cancer isn't enough to make someone stop smoking, it's hard to see why the prospect of having to pay for getting lung cancer should be much more of an incentive. Fortunately, the paper evidently still has the capacity to be embarrassed by this sort of thing. After a number of bloggers pointed out the ridiculousness of the story's logic, the Times issued a retraction. The September 29th editor's note read, quote, the article said that under previous contracts, the medical benefits were so generous that union members had little incentive to take better care of their health. This unattributed assertion, unsupported by any evidence that personal health habits are influenced by the level of health care coverage, should not have been made. Close quote. Score one for reality at the New York Times.
And finally, the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly passed a declaration on the human rights of the world's indigenous people in September. Standing opposed to the 143 nations in favor were Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the United States. A search of press coverage found a swarm of stories, but those were in Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. U.S. papers showed next to no interest. A search found just 6 mentions in major dailies. 3 of those, including one in the New York Times, were tiny world brief items. Television had even less to say. Neither ABC, NBC, or CBS had time for mention of the declaration in their nightly newscast. With 24 hours at their disposal, neither did MSNBC or CNN. But hey, don't accuse CNN of not caring about indigenous people. The network aired 2 stories on a new sneaker from Nike being promoted especially to Native Americans, with affiliate reporter Stephanie Strickland excitedly taking viewers inside the, quote, top secret Nike sports research lab, opening its doors for select media and others, close quote. CNN's story described Native Americans as a community underserved in many respects. We would just add that news outlets that prioritize corporate image management over human rights ought to be counted among those doing the underserving.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
With few exceptions, Burma, also known as Myanmar, is seldom in the U.S. news. The Burma story made something of a splash in 1988 when demonstrations were violently quashed by a military crackdown. And from time to time over the years, there have been stories about the oppression of political leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. But until the most recent cycle of violent repression, which is still underway, Burma has largely been out of the news. Joining us to talk about the situation facing pro-democracy activists in Burma and why the country seems to be such a low priority on U.S. news agendas is Dr. Cynthia Boaz, professor in the Department of Political Science and International Studies at SUNY Brockport in New York State. Boaz is also an academic advisor to the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Cynthia Boaz, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
You're welcome. Thank you for letting me be here.
Well, before we get to the media part, tell us how Burma arrived to the situation it's in today.
Well, the current story really started in 1962 when there was a military coup. A group of generals essentially took power and have been in power in some form since that time, although after the uprising in 1988, a sort of a fresh group of generals was brought in. But the country has been under extremely repressive, closed rule for the last 45 years. In fact, when you look at different organizations that study things like corruption or transparency or civil liberties in various places around the world, Burma always comes in at the bottom of the list. Maybe with a possible exception of North Korea, it has been the most closed and arguably most repressive place in the world. In 1988, there was an uprising of sorts. Some pro-democracy activists organized a series of protests. And during that time, the population of Burma was emboldened into thinking that the end to this military junta might soon be coming. But the regime viciously cracked down. The official reports were that at the time about 3,000 people were killed by the regime. Sources inside the country say the number is closer to 5,000 or 6,000. Thousands were also jailed, so the extent of the crackdown was enormous. But it opened up a very slight amount of political space to the degree that, because the regime was feeling pressure both from inside and from outside, they allowed for elections to take place in 1990. During those elections, a party that had emerged from all of the 1988 activities called the National League for Democracy actually won with, I think it was about 75% of the seats. And the leader of that party, Aung San Suu Kyi, was to become essentially the new leader had the elections actually been recognized. But of course, the junta did not recognize the election results. They declared them a fraud and put Aung San Suu Kyi into house arrest, where she has been for most of the past 19 years, but nonetheless, she's still been the symbol of democracy and freedom and the inspiration for the current wave of resistance, which has been going on since mid-August, when the regime raised fuel prices to such a degree that the already extremely economically stressed and suffering population was just pushed over the edge. The student organizers, and they had been student organizers in 1988, previous organizers, began to coordinate protests throughout the country. And it started slowly with scattered protests here or there. And then by late September, we started to see that in some places, like in the larger cities, like for example, Rangoon, the protests reached tens or even hundreds of thousands of people. And what made this wave of protests especially interesting is that the monks became the visible face of the resistance. And that became very significant for a lot of reasons, in part because it was a sign that, along with an absence of political legitimacy, which that regime has not had since it took power, that it no longer had any moral authority. And that put the regime into a huge dilemma, because to let the protests continue would have been a sign that they were giving up power. But on the other hand, to crack down on these monks would not only put their actual souls in peril in this very highly Buddhist country, but also ended up galvanizing large numbers of the population that would not otherwise have been interested or would have been too terrorized out of becoming involved in politics. In the last week or so, the regime has sequestered most of these monks away. They've made them invisible in the hope that the rest of the population will just sort of go back to life as quote-unquote normal. But in fact, that's not happened. And regardless of what the regime is saying, the resistance in Burma, from everything I've heard and understand coming from inside, is ongoing. And it's too late to undo the damage to the regime. Washing the monks' blood off the streets isn't going to change things.
In an article posted on commondreams.com, Michael Nagler writes that U.S. media mischaracterize the demonstrations in Burma often as spontaneous when they're really the product of planning. Isn't this a key element in understanding a movement that's carefully organized itself by taking cues from history?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's an issue of media responsibility. Because by covering what's been happening in Burma as spontaneous protests, it gives the impression that there's no strategy or that there's no long-term will to resist. In fact, from everything that we can tell, it looks like there are some very significant strategic dimensions to this resistance. It looks like there actually is a movement, a coordinated movement, that has been planning this for a very long time.
Can you tell us why it is you think Burma has been such a low priority on the U.S. news agenda, besides times when the country goes through bloody repression?
Yeah, first of all, one of the most obvious reasons is that the country is essentially in a complete information blackout. In terms of media or communications, probably the most closed country in the world. Not having access to information from the people, of course, makes it difficult to cover the story, although, you know, the age of the internet and cell phone definitely helps things. I think another reason for this is that there was a perception after 1988 that the resistance failed. You know, everybody sort of bought into the regime's line that they succeeded in restoring stability, that the resistance has failed, and so the world kind of threw up their hands and looked away, you know, which it isn't the first time that that's happened. And I think that took some air out of the balloon, so to speak, in terms of interest or attention on Burma. And I think the third and possibly the most significant reason is that there is a real obsession, and this is especially the case in American mainstream media, with violence. For some reason, nonviolence is always a non-story. That's extremely unfortunate because the real story here is not the repression. Everybody knew this regime would repress. That's what they do. The real story here is that resistance goes on despite the repression. They obsess about the stories that they can tell about the violence. And when they do talk about the stories from the perspective of the people, they tend to be feature stories that focus on individuals' experiences with violence, which are important. They're an important part of the story. But really, what should be interesting here to everybody is the fact that the Burmese people have said we're going to continue to go on with this resistance until this regime crumbles, despite all of this violence.
We've been speaking with Dr. Cynthia Boaz, professor in the Department of Political Science and International Studies at SUNY Brockport and academic advisor to the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Dr. Cynthia Boaz, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
For many people, the most galling moment of the recent Democratic presidential candidates' debate was when host Tim Russert asked them each to cite their favorite Bible verse. But that wasn't the only moment when religion entered the conversation. Russert also posed a question premised on an imminent crisis in Social Security, the belief in which is also a kind of gospel among many politicians and pundits. There's plenty of evidence to undermine the claim, but it can be hard to derail a political narrative that's being pushed as hard as this one, especially when reporters, for whatever reason, usually leave it basically unchallenged. Here again, then, to help us see through the smoke on the issue of Social Security and its solvency is economist Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and co-author of the book Social Security, The Phony Crisis. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Let me start by reading Tim Russert's introduction to the issue in that September 26th debate. He said, quote, "I want to talk about Social Security and Medicare. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, the head of the Government Accountability Office, have both said that the number of people in America on Social Security and Medicare is going to double in the next 20 years. There are now 40 million, it's going to go to 80 million, and that if nothing is done, we'll have to cut benefits in half or double the taxes. That is their testimony," close quote. Russert went on to ask what the candidates would do to prevent this coming shortfall. What does it say to you that the looming crisis is not even a question here, but is presumed as fact?
Well, this is obviously Russert's agenda. He's pushed it again and again and again. And, you know, I personally and others have tried to explain the information to Russert, and he seems absolutely impervious to facts. Now, he's mangled a number of things here. First and foremost is mixing Medicare and Social Security. I and others have tried to point out that, you know, the demographics are a relatively minor part of the story. Our health care system is broken. The costs are exploding. And that will be passed on in Medicare and Medicaid, the public sector programs, if we don't fix our health care system. I've been very happy that Peter Orszag, the new director of the Congressional Budget Office, has repeatedly made this point in public speaking, in Congressional Budget Office publications, and he's been very, very clear, very articulate on that. So, you know, I'm no longer the only one out there arguing that point. As far as the demographics, you know, we have the Social Security projections from the Social Security trustees and also Congressional Budget Office, which is my personal preference because they're nonpartisan, unlike the trustees. Mm-hmm. And they say if we do absolutely nothing, the current course, the program pays all benefits through the year 2046. And, you know, I mentioned on my blog that's 30 years almost after the latest possible date that the next president could leave office. So I think they could be somewhat excused if they don't have their plan for what to do in 2046. They might have more important items on their agenda. Long and short of the story, demographics do raise somewhat of an issue, but the fact is we've always been aging. Mr. Russert has his figures wrong because the percentage of the population over 65 doesn't double. It increases by about 60-70% over the next two decades, which is big, but we've been here before. That is really not that big a deal. And by comparison, you know, the cost of the Iraq War dwarf the increase in expenses that will be needed to cover Social Security. Medicare is another matter, and we should be talking about health care, but the demographics here, the aging, it's really a sidebar.
Well, dissolving Medicare into the Social Security conversation then, as Russert did, and not breaking it out separately is more confusing than anything else.
Absolutely, and it's really just a dishonest trick because Medicare is health care, and, you know, obviously we recognize Medicare is mostly, not entirely, a program that helps the elderly because it also helps disabled people, so it's not entirely for the elderly. But the real story here is that health care costs are exploding. We have to fix our health care system. And if we don't fix it, and then we talk about Medicare, we can mix in Medicare with anything. You know, the cost of Medicare and maintaining our roads is going to be enormous.
Well, Russert himself appeared not to remember an interview that he had done just days before on Meet the Press with former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, who told Russert, "Social Security is not a big crisis." I think it's interesting that this is by no means a consensus then even among conservative economists.
No, you know, basically, you know, I don't know how many times I've had this discussion with different economists who will use the Medicare and Social Security line. We always end up at the same point. And I, you know, I did see that interview that he had with Alan Greenspan, and Greenspan was very clear, as he is in his book. You know, Social Security is a manageable problem. There's a higher cost. It costs more today than it did 40 years ago. We're going to live longer. You know, that's not in particular a bad thing, and it doesn't pose any great problem. So he was misrepresenting Alan Greenspan's comments, and he also was referring to David Walker, the director of Government Accountability Office. And he, too, he's, you know, we're all looking at the same numbers. You know, he recognizes that the Social Security situation is easily a manageable one. He is one that tends to mangle the two together, but he'll tell anyone, as he did when I was on panels with him, that the issue is first and foremost health care, and if we don't fix health care, we're in really big problems, even if we didn't have an aging population.
Well, this is then an example of how what is essentially a kind of red herring can effectively derail, though, the public conversation. You've got reporters asking young people if they believe they'll ever see Social Security. We have the Washington Post criticizing Hillary Clinton for not having a plan to deal with the crisis. That, I'm guessing you would say, is not just silly, but really kind of dangerous in a way.
Yeah, it really is advancing this agenda to either privatize and or cut back benefits. And what sort of boils down to, if you just went around to people and said, what do you think of Social Security? You know, we have the polling data. It's hugely popular. 90% think it's a good program. You know, everyone, they're either getting it themselves or parents benefiting from it. They expect to benefit from it soon. So it's overwhelmingly a very, very popular, successful program by any measure. So people would never support getting rid of it or seriously cutting back unless you can convince them it's going to be dead anyhow. And having debated a number of people, you know, dating back really over a decade now, but certainly, you know, during President Bush's effort to privatize Social Security, they always begin their case by saying, we want to save Social Security. So the first point, the first step in the debate is to convince people, you know, Social Security is there in its deathbed, and the only way to rescue it is, in effect, to destroy it, at least in my view.
Well, should we be then shifting our understanding or our framing of the issue and see it not really as a legitimate debate about achieving sound policy, but really as a strategy by people who oppose a government program for throwing that program away?
I think that's the only way to see it. And what I've always said with Social Security, I mean, you could always say the program could be made better, you know, you could have this change or that change, but I think the most important thing is people have to understand the situation of the program. And until they do, you know, until we've undermined this basically a propaganda effort to scare people that the thing's on its last legs, there's no point in talking about fixing the program. The point is we have to first educate people, let people know, you know, the program is fine. Now, do we want to alter the benefits in some way? Maybe we want to make them better for some people. I think there's actually a very good argument for, you know, a lot of working women. They don't get very much in their retirement. You could raise their benefits at very, very little cost. Maybe you want to reduce some other benefits. But the point is, first and foremost, people have to recognize it's doing just fine. It's not about to go out of business. And in fact, at the moment, it's running a surplus of about $200 billion a year and it has over $2 trillion in the trust fund. So the idea is on its last legs, a little loony.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can read his blog, Beat the Press, on the American Prospect website, which is prospect.org. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.